Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. American Family Insurance can help protect your dream home for whatever comes next. You can live in your own oasis or your own clubhouse. Whatever you choose, get the right coverage. Save up to 23% by bundling home and auto. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
By the time Charles Manson was convicted in 1971, the 1960s were already dead. Not in the literal sense, of course. The calendar had already flipped over into a new decade, but the spirit of the era, the idealism, the radical optimism that had defined it had been buried under the weight of its own contradictions. And the Manson murders, they were the nail in the coffin. Before August 1969, the counterculture was still in full swing. The anti-war movement had grown too big to ignore. Civil rights activists, Black Panthers, student radicals, everywhere you looked, people were challenging the status quo. The establishment, the people in power, had a real problem on their hands. Then, in the span of 2 nights, everything changed. Suddenly, hippies weren't just harmless kids tripping on acid and playing guitars in the park. They were dangerous, unstable, capable of unthinkable violence. Charles Manson became the face of the counterculture's collapse, a wild-eyed, long-haired lunatic who symbolized everything the government wanted middle America to fear. But here's the thing. Manson was never a leader of the counterculture. He wasn't some anti-war activist. He wasn't politically engaged. He wasn't even particularly respected in the hippie scene. And yet, almost overnight, the media turned him into the movement's worst nightmare. And that was no accident. Because at the exact same time Manson was operating in California, the U.S. government was running a massive covert operation designed to destroy the counterculture from the inside out. It was called Operation Chaos. And we're going to explore that theory today.
On the night of August 8th, 1969, Sharon Tate was living the life most people could only dream of. She was 26 years old, a rising Hollywood actress, 8.5 months pregnant with her first child, and married to one of the most famous directors in the world, Roman Polanski. That evening, she had dinner at her favorite restaurant, El Coyote, with some close friends. Celebrity hairstylist Jay Sebring, coffee heiress Abigail Folger, and Folger's boyfriend, Wojciech Frykowski. It was a quiet night at home, a simple evening among friends. None of them knew they were about to become the victims of one of the most infamous mass killings in American history. Around midnight, as the guests at 10,050 Cielo Drive drifted off to sleep, a group of intruders approached the property. They weren't professional hitmen. They weren't even career criminals. They were kids, hippie drifters who had been living under the spell of Charles Manson. Leading the group was Charles Tex Watson, a former high school athlete from Texas who had somehow transformed into Manson's most devoted soldier. Alongside him were Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Linda Kasabian. Kasabian would later claim that she was just a bystander, the getaway driver, who didn't participate in the killings. But the others, they didn't hesitate. Inside the house, they unleashed chaos. Watson shot and stabbed Frykowski 51 times as he tried to escape. Krenwinkel chased down Abigail Folger, stabbing her 28 times on the lawn. Atkins and Watson attacked Jay Sebring, cutting him down next to Tate. And then there was Sharon, begging for her life, pleading for her unborn child. They killed her anyway, stabbing her 16 times. As they left, Atkins dipped her fingers in Tate's blood and scrawled a word on the front door, P-I-G. It was a scene so horrifying, so gruesome, that it made headlines around the world. But it wasn't over. The next night, Manson himself allegedly joined in. This time, the targets were Leno and Rosemary LaBianca, a wealthy couple who lived across town in Los Feliz. They were bound, stabbed, mutilated. The killers smeared messages in their blood, "Death to Pigs" and "Rise," echoing the same kind of apocalyptic rhetoric Manson had been preaching for months. Two nights, seven victims, no clear motive. And that's where Vincent Bugliosi came in. Bugliosi was the Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney assigned to the case, and from the beginning, he had a problem. None of this made any sense. These weren't mob hits. These weren't crimes of passion. And if Manson wasn't even physically at the Tate House, then why had his followers committed such horrific acts in his name? Bugliosi needed a story that would explain it all, a narrative that would connect these seemingly senseless murders into one coherent, chilling explanation. And so he found one. He called it Helter Skelter. According to Bugliosi, Charles Manson was a failed musician with delusions of grandeur, a man obsessed with the Beatles and their so-called hidden messages. He believed the White Album contained coded instructions, a prophecy foretelling an impending race war between black and white Americans. He convinced his followers that the revolution was coming, that black Americans would rise up, slaughter white people, and take over society. But according to Manson, there was a catch. Black people, he claimed, wouldn't know how to run the world once they had it. So Manson told his followers that after the war, they, his family, would emerge from the desert, take control, and become the rulers of the new society. But when this grand uprising failed to materialize on its own, Manson allegedly decided to jumpstart it. He ordered his followers to commit the Tate-LaBianca murders, making them look like acts of black revolutionaries. The idea was that law enforcement would blame the killings on groups like the Black Panthers, panic would set in, racial tensions would explode, and helter-skelter, the end of the world as we knew it, would begin. It was a theory so outrageous, so bizarre, that it was hard to believe. But Bugliosi sold it, and the jury bought it. In 1971, Charles Manson, Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten were convicted of murder and sentenced to death. Linda Kasabian, who turned state's witness, walked free. But even as the verdicts were handed down, there were questions. Questions that never quite went away. Why did Manson escape prison so many times before the murders? Who was really pulling the strings behind the investigation? And was Helter Skelter really the reason these people killed, or was it just the most convenient explanation? Because when you look closer at the details, when you examine what was left out of the official story, you start to see a different picture. A picture that suggests something far more complicated was going on. For a man who was supposedly a criminal mastermind, Charles Manson wasn't exactly subtle. Before the murders, he was arrested over and over again for drug possession, car theft, weapons charges, even running what looked an awful lot like an underage prostitution ring. He was a convicted felon on parole, actively violating the terms of his release by stockpiling weapons, using drugs, and committing acts of violence. Any one of these offenses should have landed him back in prison for years. But that never happened. Instead, time after time, Manson was let go. He slipped out through the cracks, dodging consequences like some kind of ghost in the system. And here's where things get weird, because it wasn't just dumb luck or bureaucratic oversight that kept him free. There were people in positions of power, people who should have sent him straight back to prison, who instead seemed to be protecting him. One of those people was Roger Smith, Manson's parole officer. Now, parole officers don't exist to make friends. Their job is to keep an eye on ex-cons, and if necessary, send them straight back to prison when they mess up. And yet, Roger Smith, who had an almost unnaturally close relationship with Manson, did the exact opposite. Smith wasn't just Manson's parole officer. He was also deeply connected to a government-funded research program studying the effects of LSD and mind control right in the Haight-Ashbury district, the same place Manson was living and recruiting his family. He even worked out of the free medical clinic where many of Manson's followers went for treatment. And every time Manson got arrested, Smith went to bat for him. In one instance, Manson was caught raping a 16-year-old girl in 1967, an offense that should have sent him straight back to prison. But for some reason, Smith let it slide. Another time, Manson and his followers were busted stealing cars across state lines. A federal offense. Again, nothing happened. How does an ex-con out on parole repeatedly break the law and yet keep getting released? That's not just incompetence. That's protection. And then there's the fact that the LAPD itself seemed completely uninterested in shutting Manson down, even as his cult got more violent. In early 1969, months before the murders, police raided Spahn Ranch, the dilapidated old movie set where Manson and his family were living. They arrested nearly 30 people, Manson included, for grand theft auto. They found a stash of stolen cars and weapons, enough to put Manson away for good. But guess what? Somehow, in a bureaucratic error, the paperwork for the case was mysteriously lost. The charges were dropped, and Manson walked free. That wasn't the first time crucial evidence just happened to disappear. After the Tate-LaBianca murders, police reportedly found an audio tape confession, a recording that may have implicated Manson and his family in additional murders that were never publicly linked to them. But before anyone could act on it, the tape vanished. To this day, no one knows exactly what was on it or why it was never used in court. And it gets stranger. Meet Reeve Whitson. You won't find his name in Bugliosi's Helter Skelter. He wasn't a prosecutor. He wasn't a police officer. He wasn't even an informant in the traditional sense. But according to multiple sources, Whitson was a well-connected government operative, one with direct ties to intelligence agencies like the CIA. And he knew about the Tate murders before the police did. According to Sharak Hatami, a close friend of Sharon Tate, Whitson called him 90 minutes before the bodies were found, before the press, before law enforcement, to warn that something terrible had happened at Cielo Drive. How did Whitson know about the murders before anyone else, and why was he so involved in the aftermath? Over the years, multiple witnesses came forward claiming that Whitson worked behind the scenes, steering key witnesses and controlling the narrative of the case. One of those witnesses, Hatami himself, later claimed that Whitson threatened him into testifying the way the prosecution wanted. If Whitson was truly just some interested outsider, why was he inserting himself into a high-profile murder case, pressuring witnesses, and seemingly directing the investigation from the shadows? Bugliosi, for all his grandstanding in Helter Skelter, never mentions Whitson, not even once. He ignores the fact that someone with intelligence ties had prior knowledge of the murders. He never explains why key witnesses later claimed they were coerced into testimony that perfectly fit the Helter Skelter narrative. And speaking of testimony, let's talk about how shaky some of those statements really were. Take Susan Atkins. She was the first family member to spill the details of the murders, first to fellow inmates, then to law enforcement. It was her confession that laid the groundwork for the Helter Skelter theory. But her story kept changing. At first, she claimed Manson had nothing to do with the murders. Then later, she insisted he planned them all along. She said that she killed Sharon Tate. Then she said Tex Watson did it while she just held Tate down. And the kicker. Years later, Atkins admitted that most of what she originally told police was a lie. So why did her testimony, riddled with inconsistencies, become the backbone of the case? Because it was the story that fit. Bugliosi had a clear motive in mind, helter-skelter, and everything else was just details that could be bent to fit the narrative. He ignored the fact that Manson himself seemed completely uninterested in race war rhetoric. According to multiple accounts from family members, Manson never spoke about helter-skelter the way Bugliosi described it. Yes, he made references to the Beatles and their music. Yes, he talked about chaos and upheaval. But the idea that he was orchestrating a grand race war, that was Bugliosi's interpretation. And that interpretation became law. Once Bugliosi had Helter Skelter as his central theory, every other possible motive, drug deals gone wrong, personal vendettas, outside influences, was pushed aside. Evidence that didn't fit the story was buried. Witnesses who wavered in their testimony were strong-armed into remembering the right things, and it worked. Bugliosi secured convictions for every single defendant. Manson and his followers were sentenced to death, later commuted to life in prison. The public, desperate for an explanation that made sense, bought the helter-skelter story. And for decades, no one questioned it. But the cracks were there from the very beginning, the missing evidence, the shadowy informants, the parole officer who refused to lock Manson up, a prosecutor who had too perfect a theory, a government operative lurking behind the scenes, and a crime so messy that the neatest answer was probably not the real one. The closer you look, the more obvious it becomes. The official story wasn't just about explaining the murders. It was about controlling them. And once you see that, you have to ask, if the real motive wasn't helter-skelter, then what was it? Charles Manson was a two-bit criminal before he became a cult leader. He was a petty con man, a car thief, a guy who spent most of his life behind bars. And yet somehow, when he got out of prison in 1967, he had developed a supernatural ability to manipulate people so effectively that he could convince them to kill for him. That kind of control doesn't just happen. It's not something you pick up in a prison yard. And when you start looking at where Manson was and who he was in contact with during those years, things start getting a whole lot stranger. Because Manson didn't just appear in Haight-Ashbury by accident, and he wasn't just some hippie guru who stumbled into a group of lost kids. He was in the right place at the right time, with the right people watching him. And those people? They weren't just hippies. They were doctors, scientists, government-funded researchers who were studying mind control. And that's where things start to take a turn. In the 1950s and 60s, the CIA was obsessed with one thing: controlling the human mind. They wanted to know if they could break it, rewire it, program it to do things against a person's will without them even realizing it. The idea was simple. If you could control a person's thoughts, you could control their actions. You could create the perfect assassin. That's where MKUltra came in. MKUltra was a top-secret CIA program designed to test the limits of the human mind. The agency poured millions of dollars into experiments involving LSD, hypnosis, sensory deprivation, and psychological torture, all in the hopes of finding a way to control people without them knowing they were being controlled. They experimented on prisoners, psychiatric patients, even ordinary citizens who had no idea they were part of an experiment. Some were dosed with LSD and subjected to hours of mind-breaking interrogation. Others were put through sleep deprivation, electroshock therapy, and techniques designed to break their sense of self. One of MKUltra's top doctors was a man named Louis Jolly West. West was a psychiatrist with direct ties to the CIA. He specialized in behavior modification, breaking down a person's identity and rebuilding it from scratch. He had worked with the government on classified psychological projects for years, and in 1967, the same year Charles Manson was released from prison, Jolly West just happened to set up a free clinic in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district, the exact place where Manson was living, recruiting, and testing his own mind control techniques on his followers. Coincidence? Because here's the thing. West's clinic wasn't just some neighborhood medical office. It was a covert research operation. West's work was heavily funded by CIA front organizations, specifically those connected to MKUltra. His goal was to study how drugs, particularly LSD, affected the minds of hippies, criminals, and the so-called counterculture. And right in the middle of all of this was Charles Manson. Manson and his followers frequented that clinic. They got treatment there. They met people there. And Manson, who had spent most of his life locked up, suddenly developed a bizarre ability to control people's thoughts using many of the same techniques MKUltra was studying at the time. He used LSD to break people down. He isolated them, deprived them of sleep, then flooded their senses with mantras, repetition, and a constant barrage of suggestion. He used sex as a tool to manipulate. He turned his followers into blank slates, erasing their past selves until they were nothing but extensions of his will. And doesn't that sound exactly like what the CIA was trying to do? Now, does that mean Manson was directly trained by MKUltra? Not necessarily. But the overlap is undeniable. Jolly West was running a government-funded mind control clinic in the exact place where Manson was actively learning and practicing the same techniques. And even stranger, when West's research in Haight-Ashbury ended, he went on to study violent cults and the process of brainwashing. He even became an expert witness in high-profile trials involving killers who claimed they had been programmed to kill. Almost as if he knew exactly how the process worked. And Manson wasn't the only one who seemed to benefit from whatever was happening in that clinic. Other figures from that time, people involved in cults, assassinations, and violent radical groups, seemed to have connections to these same networks of covert psychological research. Take Sirhan Sirhan, the man who assassinated Robert F. Kennedy in 1968. Sirhan had no memory of shooting Kennedy, none. Witnesses described him as if he were in a trance, robotic, repeating phrases over and over like he was on autopilot. His lawyers later argued that he had been hypnotically programmed, that he had been conditioned to kill. And wouldn't you know it? Jolly West just happened to have access to him. West was brought in to evaluate Sirhan after his arrest. And guess what West concluded? He said Sirhan had no true memory of the shooting, as if something had wiped his mind clean. Now, does this mean West was part of some sinister plot to program killers? That he personally trained Manson, Sirhan, and others to commit crimes as part of a larger agenda? Not necessarily. But the fact that the same names, the same research programs, and the same psychological techniques keep popping up around some of the most violent, inexplicable crimes of that era, that's not something you can ignore. And let's not forget, Manson wasn't alone in this. His followers, his so-called family, weren't just ordinary kids who suddenly turned homicidal. Many of them came from broken homes, troubled pasts, but once they fell under Manson's control, they changed. And that change followed a pattern that eerily mirrors documented MKUltra methods. Isolation, sleep deprivation, drug-induced trance states, repetitive mantras, the complete destruction of identity. These weren't just hippies gone wrong. These were people who had been systematically broken down and rebuilt. And that's what makes the connection to MKUltra so chilling. Because if you can control a person's mind, you can control their actions. And if someone wanted to create real-life killers, people who would do the unthinkable without question, without hesitation, they wouldn't have to look much further than what Manson did. And the fact that his methods so perfectly align with what government researchers were already studying, that's not just a coincidence. That's something worth investigating. Because Manson wasn't just a cult leader. He was a product of something bigger. And the more you look at it, the more you start to wonder, was he really the mastermind, or was he just another pawn? By the time Charles Manson was convicted in 1971, the 1960s were already dead. Not in the literal sense, of course. The calendar had already flipped over into a new decade. But the spirit of the era, the idealism, the radical optimism that had defined it, had been buried under the weight of its own contradictions. And the Manson murders, they were the nail in the coffin. Before August 1969, the counterculture was still in full swing. The anti-war movement had grown too big to ignore. Civil rights activists, Black Panthers, student radicals, everywhere you looked, people were challenging the status quo. The establishment, the people in power, had a real problem on their hands. And then, in the span of two nights, everything changed. Suddenly, hippies weren't just harmless kids tripping on acid and playing guitars in the park. They were dangerous, unstable, capable of unthinkable violence. Charles Manson became the face of the counterculture's collapse, a wild-eyed, long-haired lunatic who symbolized everything the government wanted middle America to fear. But here's the thing. Manson was never a leader of the counterculture. He wasn't some anti-war activist. He wasn't politically engaged. He wasn't even particularly respected in the hippie scene. And yet, almost overnight, the media turned him into the movement's worst nightmare. And that was no accident. Because at the exact same time Manson was operating in California, the U.S. government was running a massive covert operation designed to destroy the counterculture from the inside out. It was called Operation CHAOS. Most people have never heard of Operation Chaos, and there's a reason for that. The CIA wasn't exactly eager to advertise it. Officially, the CIA isn't supposed to spy on American citizens. Their job is foreign intelligence, monitoring threats overseas, dealing with enemies abroad. But during the 1960s, the agency made an exception because they saw a new kind of enemy, not a foreign power, not an armed militia, but their own citizens. The people protesting the war in Vietnam, marching for civil rights, pushing back against the establishment. These weren't just kids with signs. In the eyes of the U.S. government, they were a threat. And not just any threat, a national security risk. So in 1967, the CIA launched Operation Chaos, a top-secret program aimed at infiltrating, monitoring, and ultimately discrediting the anti-war movement. The plan was simple: make the movement look dangerous. Agents infiltrated protests posing as activists. They planted informants inside civil rights groups, anti-war organizations, feminist movements, anywhere people were challenging the system. They wiretapped leaders, intercepted mail, even manipulated the press to push stories that would turn the public against the movement. And the FBI, they were in on it too. Under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI had already been running COINTELPRO, another secret program aimed at destroying radical political groups. They spied on Martin Luther King Jr., tried to get him to commit suicide. They framed Black Panther leaders, labeling them criminals. They set people up, turning activists against each other, fueling paranoia and violence within the movement. The goal was never just surveillance. The goal was to control the narrative, to make the counterculture seem like a threat to everyday Americans. And what better way to do that than to have the most infamous murder spree of the decade be committed by a group of acid-tripping hippies? The Manson murders were exactly what the government needed. They weren't just brutal, they were symbolic. A hippie commune in the desert, a cult leader preaching revolution, young white kids turning into bloodthirsty killers. It played right into every fear middle America had about the youth movement. Almost overnight, the media turned on the counterculture. Before 1969, the Beatles were the biggest band in the world. Their message? Peace, love, a new way of thinking. But after the murders, Bugliosi and the media linked Manson to the Beatles. Suddenly, Helter Skelter wasn't just a song. It was a prophecy, a warning. Before 1969, the hippie movement was about communal living, dropping out of the system, questioning authority. But after the murders, hippie communes were seen as potential death cults. Before 1969, LSD was a mind-expanding experience, a way to free yourself from societal constraints. But after the murders, LSD was a weapon, the thing that turned Manson's followers into killers. It was the perfect storm, a real-life horror story that made people afraid of the counterculture. And that's exactly what the government wanted. And here's the part that doesn't sit right. Law enforcement had multiple opportunities to shut Manson down before the murders. He was on parole. He was committing crimes constantly. He had ties to violent individuals. Police raided Spahn Ranch and let him go. His parole officer ignored every red flag. Why? Why let a dangerous criminal walk free unless he was useful? Because here's what we do know. At the same time the government was looking for ways to discredit the counterculture, Charles Manson was being allowed to roam free, gathering followers, testing his control. And then, at exactly the right moment, he became the poster child for everything wrong with the movement. The timing is suspicious, too perfect. And even after the murders, things didn't add up. Remember Reeve Whitson, the mysterious intelligence operative who knew about the killings before the police did? He wasn't just involved, he was actively influencing witnesses, steering the investigation. Remember how Bugliosi ignored other possible motives for the killings? Remember how the prosecution's entire case was built on a theory that conveniently fit the government's narrative? It all points to something bigger. Manson was never the mastermind of the counterculture's downfall. He was the weapon. And whether he was used intentionally or whether it was just convenient to let him do what he did, the result was the same. The 60s ended in blood. The public turned against the hippies. The government cracked down on radical movements harder than ever before. And the message was clear. This is what happens when you question the system. This is what happens when you go too far. The Manson case didn't just change true crime history. It changed American history. And if you think the story stops here, you haven't been paying attention. And for more than 50 years, we've been told that Charles Manson was an anomaly, a one-of-a-kind monster who took a group of wayward kids and turned them into killers. We've been told that his vision of Helter Skelter, his obsession with the Beatles, and his doomsday prophecies were what drove his followers to slaughter strangers in the night. We've been told that Manson was simply a byproduct of the 1960s gone wrong. But when you look at the facts, the ones that were ignored, buried, or explained away, it becomes clear that this case was never as simple as it seemed. Manson was a career criminal who should have been locked up long before he ever sent his followers to Cielo Drive. Instead, he was released time and time again, while under the watch of a parole officer who had direct ties to government-funded psychological experiments. He landed in Haight-Ashbury at the exact time intelligence-linked psychiatrists were running LSD mind control studies on the counterculture. He developed an unnatural ability to break people down and reshape their minds using the same techniques that CIA programs like MKUltra were studying. And just when the U.S. government needed a way to demonize the counterculture, Charles Manson and his cult of drugged-out killers served up the perfect narrative. If you put all of that together, one thing is undeniable. The official story isn't the full story. And that raises some troubling questions. The biggest question of all is, who was protecting Manson before the murders? We know that Manson violated his parole dozens of times. We know that police arrested him and his followers multiple times, only to have charges mysteriously dropped. And we know that when the LAPD had a perfect chance to shut him down, raiding Spahn Ranch and finding stolen cars, weapons, and underage girls being trafficked, someone made sure the charges disappeared. Why? Who had the power to override local law enforcement? Who wanted Manson out in the world instead of behind bars? And was it because he was useful? If you strip away the myth, Manson wasn't just a manipulative cult leader. He was an experiment in control. A real-world demonstration of how a person could be broken down, rebuilt, and conditioned to act without question. Was he a deliberate product of government mind control programs, a pawn used to test how far psychological manipulation could go? Or was he simply a naturally occurring phenomenon, someone who, by pure coincidence, figured out on his own what intelligence agencies had been spending decades trying to master? We don't have the answer to that, and the people who do, they aren't talking. There's another question that's just as unsettling. How many other murders did the Manson family commit that we still don't know about? The killings at Cielo Drive and the LaBianca home were just the ones that made headlines. But investigators have long suspected that the Manson family was responsible for far more deaths. Murders that were either never solved, never connected to Manson, or quietly swept under the rug. There's evidence suggesting that Manson ordered other killings before and after the Tate-LaBianca murders. We know that some members of his group later hinted at additional crimes, only to have those confessions disappear into sealed files or ignored by authorities. And then there's the missing confession tape, the recorded evidence that could have linked Manson's group to more victims, but conveniently vanished before it could be used. What was on that tape? And why did the LAPD bury it? The problem with a case like this, the problem with any case that suggests government involvement, is that the moment you start questioning the official narrative, people roll their eyes. It gets labeled a conspiracy theory and dismissed outright. But let's be honest. What we've covered isn't theory. It's documented fact. The U.S. government did run mind control experiments on its own citizens. That's not speculation. That's MKUltra, a program that existed for decades before being exposed. The CIA did infiltrate and sabotage social movements, planting agents inside anti-war groups, civil rights organizations, and radical political circles. That's Operation CHAOS, another program that was declassified years later. The FBI did manipulate criminal cases, destroy evidence, and use psychological warfare against perceived threats. That's COINTELPRO, which they were forced to admit after documents were leaked. So when you look at Manson's story and see the fingerprints of these exact same programs, is it really so far-fetched to ask whether he was part of something bigger? Is it really so crazy to think that the official version of this story, a wild-eyed cult leader causing mass murder because of a Beatles song, might not be the full truth? Because here's the reality. We know that governments lie. We know that intelligence agencies operate in shadows. And we know that history gets rewritten, not always to find the truth, but sometimes to bury it. And that brings us to the real reason this case still matters today. Because Manson wasn't just a criminal, he was a weaponized story, a tool used to reshape public perception at a critical moment in history. Think about it. The Manson murders weren't just horrific crimes. They were a message, a warning about what happens when social movements go too far. After Manson, the counterculture wasn't seen as a movement for peace. It was seen as a breeding ground for cults, brainwashing, and violence. The government used that fear to clamp down on activism, radical politics, and civil rights groups in ways that lasted decades. And the tactic didn't end there. Because if you fast forward to today, the same strategies are still being used. Fear-based narratives are still shaping how people think. Governments still use the media to control public perception. Intelligence agencies still manipulate movements that threaten the status quo. Look at how protesters are portrayed today. Look at how social unrest is reported. Look at how fear is used to justify surveillance, crackdowns, and control. The Manson case was an early example of psychological warfare, a case study in how crime, media, and government agendas can intersect to reshape history. And if we let those in power tell us what to believe without questioning, without looking deeper, then we're just as controlled as the people in the Manson family. So ask yourself, how many other stories have been rewritten? How many other truths have been buried? And how much of what we think we know is a lie?
That's all for now. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our updates on this and the many cases we cover for you here at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. He was charming, handsome, a devoted husband, a doting father. When his wife died tragically in a freak accident, everyone pitied him. He played the role so well, grieving widower, devastated, single dad, just trying to put the pieces back together. But the thing about perfect men, they're usually hiding something. And this one was hiding everything. The affair, the insurance policy, the other wife in another state who had no idea she was married to a walking crime scene. If she had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, She could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, she could have seen through the lies. She could have gotten out while she still had the chance. Instead, she's just another case we'll be covering next week. Don't be her. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off 2 or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.